Thank you. I'm Otto, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, hi, Otto.
It's nice to be at the Fall Classic in St. Louis, the 23rd. Appreciate y'all putting this together in time for me to get sober so I could be here 23 years later. And Georgia got me a big old clock up here, buddy. I abused George and Beverly at a conference in Colorado a few years back, and I've tried to make amends for that, and I'll try to make a living amends tonight, George. It does take a lot of time to come and do these things, and I do travel a lot and spend a lot of time away from my family and weekends, three-day weekends and stuff I don't get to spend at home. But there's nothing I'd rather be doing than being of service to you guys, because I know what an impact the speakers that I heard when I was early in my sobriety had on me. Paul O. literally changed my life in an hour. You know, and if I can help anybody, well, I love to turn the tragedy that was my life into a tool and an asset. But the sacrifice I make is nothing compared to what George and his lovely wife do, because they drove here, they didn't fly, and they brought all their own equipment, which they paid for. And, you know, they're going to provide those tapes and CDs to you guys tonight as a service, even though you'll pay a very small fee for them. And it helps to spread the word. So I've got a clock here, George, and it says 9:30. I'm going to be done. In Colorado, I was talking, and you could hear George screaming in the corner and throwing tapes and shit, because I was about an hour and a half into it. You know. I do love you, George. Go. Okay, here we go. I am Autumn Alcoholic. Thanks, Mike, for picking me up timely at the airport. Thanks, Kate, for dinner. Weld, I'm sorry that you're ill and can't be here tonight. I hope you get to hear the tape, and I'll dedicate this talk to you tonight. Hope that you feel better. I am a for real alcoholic. When I drink alcohol, I tend to drink too much. I tend to go places I might not normally go. I tend to say things that I regret having said. I probably might do something that I will regret having done when I drink alcohol. Yet I never ever saw drinking as a problem. You know, I like to drink. I enjoy drinking. Like the taste of it. I can drink a lot. I'm an excuse drinker. I had 1,000 excuses for why I got drunk. Never did I ever consider the idea that I might be alcoholic. I had no idea what an alcoholic was until you came and did what I'm doing tonight. One of you all stood up and talked about your own alcoholism in the first person. And it was the only time I was able to hear. And that's the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. One alcoholic sharing with another in the first person their personal experience with alcohol. Because I had a lot of wonderful people that tried to help me my whole life. I've always been surrounded by kind and generous people. And whenever they'd start out a sentence, it'd always be, you know, Otto, you drink too much. Otto, you stay out too late. Otto, you take too many pills. Otto, you need to save a little money. Otto, you really need to get up and go to work. You know? And they never could help me, because all their sentences started with Otto, you. And you see, I know that you don't understand. Ain't nobody gonna tell me nothing. You don't understand. That was my pat answer for any of these nice people that tried to help me. You just don't understand. You see, I got a lot of problems. Problems are us. I got some serious problems. And if you had my problems, then you might have a drink too. You know? Matter of fact, let me tell you about some of my problems. You'll probably buy me a drink, okay? So I had lots of excuses for drinking and never saw myself as a problem drinker, didn't know what an alcoholic was. Never tried to quit drinking. I was thrilled to see so many hands of new people and young in sobriety people here. That just fires me up and makes me want to tell you how wonderful this program has been for me. Never had a clue. You know, I thought an alcoholic was like W.C. Fields or something, you know, like I saw on TV, you know, just some red-nosed, overweight guy, slurred his speech, he can talk, you know, and hell, I'm a stud, you know? I can't relate to W.C. Fields, yeah. And I've never even heard of AA or Alcoholics Anonymous. And I grew up in a home where everybody drinks. My mom and dad drink to excess. I mean, I was affected by alcoholism long before I ever had my first drink. You know, my family, my mom and dad married and divorced, married and divorced, married and divorced each other. Three times before I got out of high school. They couldn't live with each other. They couldn't live without each other. You know, when we had a birthday party or an anniversary or something, well, we held the party at the tavern. You know, when we have birthdays and Christmas presents and stuff, we give each other alcohol and drugs for gifts. I never saw anything queer about being drunk or rowdy. You know, Christmas is the holiday from hell at my house. Because all the kids, I got two younger brothers and an older sister, we're all married and divorced and married and divorced and married and divorced, and we all got multiple families, and 18, the kids have all got, you know, 18 sets of grandparents, and they all want a piece of them on Christmas, and, you know, you put on your track shoes Christmas Eve, and you take off, and, you know, we don't have a family tree, it's a family thicket, and you're just trying to get through there and see as many of them and please as many of them as you can, you know, and there's a better chance that a squad car is going to show up at my mom's house than Santa. And, you know, there was a lot of violence and a lot of chaos in the house I grew up in. And, you know, we don't, there's a lot of silly rules, you know. I mean, in my house, you know, big boys don't cry. Don't you cry, boy, I'll give you something to cry about. You know, don't you be afraid. You shouldn't be afraid. Don't you be afraid. There's something wrong with you if you're afraid. Don't feel bad. You can't feel bad. If you feel bad, there's something wrong with you. You're doing something wrong. Don't feel bad. Always give a man a good hand. Always tell the truth. That's my favorite rule. Tell the truth. Truth gets you killed at my house. You know, I can just see it now. Dad, it just, you know, it just really scares me when you hit mom. You know, it really scares me. Yeah, if I want to die, I might want to say that to him. Shoot. Yeah. You know, for Father's Day and stuff like that, Mom's Day, you know, I have to send those generic cards. You know, do you ever go to the Hallmark section and you're looking for a card for your brother or your sister or your mom or your dad, and there are all these flowery cards, you know, about what a wonderful dad, and you're my best friend, and thanks for always being there, you know, and stuff. Well, I can't send that to my dad. He came up to the school and got in a fight in a drunken stupor with my football coach my senior year, and I wound up getting kicked off the team, you know. Way to be there, Dad. Way to go. You know? Now, we got to find the card that just says, Happy Father's Day, you know. That's it. Nothing else. You know what? And I swore I wouldn't be like my dad, but I got a lot of those Happy Father's Day cards, you know. Damn. Wasn't the plan. I could not wait to get out of that house. You know, I couldn't wait to get away from the violence and the chaos and the, you know, the sickness and the, just, you know, I was so happy to get away. And I went off to Oklahoma State University. I'm the first member of my family on either side to ever graduate from high school. Neither of my parents graduated from high school. My older sister did not graduate from high school, and neither of my younger brothers graduated from high school. I'm the only member of my family of six to have his own teeth past 40. Alcohol will rot your teeth if some of y'all been drinking for a while. And I was glad to get out of that house. And I went off to Oklahoma State, and of course, we're poor. You know, I grew up dirt poor. My daddy's a police officer. We really couldn't afford for me to go to school, and I was trying real hard to be good, you know, but I spent way too much time drinking and playing and not enough time studying and going into class, and I didn't do very well in school, so I got drafted. Shoot. You know, 1967, not a good time to get drafted. You know, I have to realize, you know, that most of the people in the audience, you know, Clint, you guys are all way too young to remember the Vietnam War, but... In 67, there was a nasty gas war going on over in Southeast Asia. But, you know, I'm bulletproof and invisible. So I decided, well, you know, I'll go ahead and go into service, and I'll do a little stint with them, you know, and then I'll come back to school and I can go on the GI Bill. Does that make sense? You know, I mean, it made sense to me. I don't know about you guys, but my best thinking sucks. Best plans rarely work, but, you know, I've always got one. And this was the plan. And, you know, in high school, I, you know, all this stuff's going on at my house, but at school you'd never know it. Because, see, I'm top team. I'm friendliest boy at school. I'm class president. I emcee the pep rallies. I head up the paper drives. You know, I play all the sports. You know, I'm a stud. I want y'all to know that. What a stud I am. And, you know, so I go in the military, and I fully expect to be made a general's aide. You know, put me in charge of the motor pool. I love cars. Or, you know, put me in charge of the NCO club. That place will rock, you know? Yeah. That's not what they did, though. I don't know about you guys. I've never caught a break. I've just always been on the short end of the stick, and they gave me a rifle and declared me an infantryman. Whoa, wait a minute, you know? I did everything I could do to avoid going to Vietnam as an infantryman, but the best I could do was get through Betty Crocker School and NCOCS, and I went to Vietnam as a buck sergeant. I thought it'd be better to go as a squad leader than a, you know, just a little guy that had to follow the leader. I'd rather be the leader. More of my best thinking, that didn't work. They put me in a squad with 9 guys, and I'd take 3 guys, and we'd go off the fire base, and we'd go out for 3 days and 2 nights. And I'd come back, get 3 other guys, we'd go out for 3 days and 2 nights, come back. Then I'd get 3 other guys, we'd go out for 3 days and 2 nights, come back. Then I'd take all 9 of them, we'd go out for 3 days and 2 nights, and come back. Then we'd go out on a platoon exercise, 3 days, 2 nights. Well, guess who's out there every damn night? Old Sarge here, you know? And so every time something happens, I'm in it. You know, and it didn't take me long to get hurt in Vietnam. Vietnam was a horrible experience. Wonderful excuse to drink. Y'all just don't understand how horrible, how terrible combat is. You don't know what it's like to see the horrors of war. They could not have prepared me. You know, the day before I was wounded, we went in on a hot LZ. We knew the enemy was going to be there. We went in with just weapons and water. We didn't even take rucks or food or anything with us because we knew we were going to be in for a fight. And they kicked our butts. And there weren't very many of us that got in on the ground. We went in on a jungle mountain, and they'd just blown the LZ, and it was too small, and we couldn't get enough guys in there fast enough, and the rockets were coming out of the trees and blowing those helicopters up, and they're down, and the LZ's on fire, and we can't get any help in. And the CO radios down to me, and he says, Otto, we're going to drop some firefighting equipment to you. We're going to drop some plastic explosives in there for you, man. We need you to blow down some of those trees and make that landing zone bigger and put some of that fire out. You guys need some help. And I'm going, I know. And I'm watching him as he comes hovering over the LZ to drop that stuff to us. And here come another rocket. Shoo, pop. Here goes his helicopter, wobbles and falls into the fire. And me and a kid named Henderson ran out onto that LZ and started getting those guys out of that helicopter. And one of them had been blown out the door. We went into the tree line and found him, and he's a mess. He's got no legs. You know, he was sitting on that transmission, and when it blew up, it come right out and just took his legs off. He's got no face. His arm's mangled. He's a mess, but he's still alive. You know, and we used our bootlaces to put tourniquets high on his thighs to try to stop the bleeding. We put pressure all over him, trying to keep him from bleeding to death, trying to stop the bleeding from his face and his head without suffocating him, trying to keep him from crying so that he wouldn't draw fire so the enemy wouldn't hear him. And the medic finally came and took over, and I never knew who that kid was, and I never saw him again, except at night when I'd lay down to go to sleep. See, and you guys don't understand. You don't understand. I have difficulty getting to sleep at night. When I try to lay down to sleep, I see my dad hitting my mom. When I try to lay down to sleep, I see my buddies in Vietnam. You don't understand. I always had a lot of, golly, anybody gonna buy me a drink yet? Anybody play the harmonica? I'd love you to come up here and just do a little Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen in the background. Yeah? Just kind of soft, you know, be cool. Yeah. Next day, I walked up on an enemy position and I was shot twice. If you've ever heard the expression, we're going to blow your ass off. That's what happened. Yeah. One bullet went right through my left ankle. The other one went right through my left hip. Blew my gluteus maximus off. And separated my femur from my pelvis and shattered my pelvis. They dusted me off, sent me to a hospital in Yokota, Japan. I was there 7 weeks, and I went to a hospital in California and a hospital in Texas. And I finally wound up back at Reynolds Army Hospital, Fort Sill, Oklahoma, so I could be close to my family. I want to get that support, you know. Don't you cry. spent 9 months in a cast from my chest down. Had a gross staph infection, would not heal. Would not heal. They just kept cutting pieces of me off. They put big old screws in my hip that just shoved my leg up into my pelvis. Put these huge screws going every which direction, trying to get it to grow together solid. No hip joint, just grow together solid. They fused my ankle solid. When I turned 21, I'd been in the hospital 4 months. When I turned 22, I was still there. It would not heal. I had pus draining out of my left buttocks for 7 years. I live with chronic pain every day. You see, that hip never fused, but it was just bone on bone, about 5 degrees of motion, just enough to hurt like hell. And I'm an angry veteran, you know, and I'm in a lot of pain. Don't begrudge me my drink. I can't get to sleep at night. Pills I take are prescribed. Most of them. Come on. I was a dock worker. It's a lot easier then than now. I feel sorry for you poor people now with these wonderful drugs they've got. Jeez, you know, they got computers keeping records. You get caught taking lots of those. You know, I took a lot. And I never had to worry about a computer catching me. You know, I could just walk into any clinic anywhere and just drop my pants and they'd go, oh, shit, what do you need? Yeah, that hurts. That hurts. Yeah. Woo, woo. Double that script. Okay. Yeah, and I'm just... Never took a pill I didn't need. Or I was going to need it pretty soon, you know? I'm not into martyrdom, you know, I really got tired of waiting for the pain, you know, and then you take the pill and then you gotta wait a half hour for it to give you a little relief. Now, let's cut to the chase, okay, I'm not into pain. So I'm drinking and I'm doing drugs and I don't have a clue that I've got any problems other than you. You and the VA and my ex-wives and my kids and the creditors and the judicial system, and yeah, nobody understands. You know, my life's hard. God, it's hard. I don't know how I'd do it without pain pills and without a little drink to knock the edge off at night. I mean, you talk about sleeping on the grass and stuff. You know, I'm one of the guys. You ever have to throw your leg off the side of the bed to get the room to stop going? You know, just please stop. Really, I mean, I need some sleep because I got to get up and go to work tomorrow. I haven't been in a few days. Yeah, and I'm married and divorced. Now, I mean, I end up unemployed and unemployable. You know, I got that college degree and went and got a good job. And I've always been, it seems like, you know, I'm an overachiever and a perfectionist. I thought those were my attributes when I got here, you know. And didn't know that was killing me, but anyway, I didn't own a dog, I didn't have a cat, I didn't have nothing, but I had no idea that drinking was a problem. I never tried to quit. Quitting was not, what a ridiculous concept. Quit drinking. What would life, you know, if I would just live a life that's like fingernails on a chalkboard if I quit drinking, you know? I mean, come on, what do you want? You having a nice day, Otto? You know, and I'm trying to be a good son, I'm trying to be a good husband, I'm trying to be a good father, you know, I'm trying to be a good employee, I'm trying to be a good neighbor, I'm trying to be a good citizen, you know, I'm dancing as fast as I can. I just want to be a good guy, and I just want you to like me, you know. And it ain't working. It ain't working, and I hate me. I hate me. I really do. I loathe me. You know, I used to go out to the clubs and dance and have fun. No, I stay home and I drink by myself now. You know, I just stay home and drink. And I felt totally justified in every drink. I felt so sorry for me because life had been so unfair. You know, denial's a bitch. In our book, they don't call it denial, they call it delusion. You know, and I like that because, you know, denial kind of insinuates that there's some dishonesty involved, you know, that I'm deceiving someone. You know, delusion, hell, it's my truth. You know, it's my reality. You know, and I was really, I can be delusional now. I can be delusional today. I tell you what, how bad it got. I'm a puking drunk. I puked the first time I drank in high school. You know, we sat out in the beer, out in the field, a bunch of my buddies, and we popped those beers, and I got drunk and threw up. Fell down the street, almost got run over, you know, went to some little girl's house and knocked on the window, and her parents caught us, and we all ran. Oh, and I hit a for sale sign in the yard, ripped my leg open, you know, we had a great time. And, you know, that's just the kind of way drinking was for me always. You know, I didn't get drunk every time I drank, but I got drunk a lot when I didn't mean to or need to. You know, my daughter's 10th birthday, I was just going to stop and have a drink on the way home. You know, she's having a slumber party. It's important that I be there. I show up about 11:30, drunk, embarrass her just like my daddy embarrassed me, you know, trying to be cute, trying to talk valley talk and be one, be an 11-year-old, you know, be a 10-year-old. Yeah, hey, oh, yeah, oh. Shameful. Never had a clue of the damage I was doing. Never had a clue. Towards the end of my drinking career, I'm a racing fan. I like car races, NASCAR. You know, y'all got a track here now, don't you? They're running right now, by the way, on TV. I went to Florida to Daytona 500 and Speed Weeks. So I go down there a lot, and I'm at the car races. I don't have any friends anymore. I'm pretty much running solo, and I drove down there and hooked up with some good old boys. You know, I'm real sociable, so I can meet up with some good old boys. You know, they're the guys carrying the big cooler up into the grandstand, you know. Yeah, I never hook up with the family with the kids and the little Playmate coolers. You know, it's always the guys with the big ones. Yeah, we're going to drink some serious beer drink. So we're going around to the fairs and the racetracks and going. They have races for a week. They have races during the day, races at night. We happen to be at the Tampa State Fairgrounds for the late models, running on a mile there during the state fair. And we're walking and enjoying the races and drinking cold beer, and I'm eating those little pills. I like to wear 501 blue jeans. I got that little pocket right there, and I carry my pills in there, you know. And I just eat those little pills. All the time. Well, what you got there, Otto? Oh, tic-tac. Can I have one? Nope, oh, sorry, all out. The races are over, and we walk around the fairgrounds. The fair's going on. We're eating corny dogs and throwing balls at Cupid dolls and looking at the girls and having a great time. We leave them. We go to a nightclub. Now I'm in my environment, see, because I can dance. I might be crippled, but the one-hip slip will drive you crazy, okay? And I got my fake alligator boots on, and I got my fake gold bracelet on. And I know all you girls want me. I know you do. Which one of you little lucky gals is going on with me tonight? Woo! Remember, the place was called the Pit. It just had a big hole in the ground, you know, and you'd go down in the pit and dance. You know, in other words, this is the 80s, you know. And, God, I've been drinking 12, 14 hours this day, you know. And I come staggering out of that club, you know, 2 in the morning. And it's cold in February in Florida at 2 in the morning, you know. But I'm sweating. I'm holding onto the car in the parking lot so I don't fall down. That stuff just come blowing out of my face. It's all over the car. It's all over my boots. It's on my pants. Oh, it's coming out of my nose. I got little pieces of Stay Fair corn dog in my nose. Oh, God. Go back in the club.
Get me another drink. Tell that little girl. I got sick, man.
I promise you, I swear I will never, ever, ever again, as long as I live, ever eat another State Fair corn dog. That greasy damn thing made me sick. And that was my truth. You see, I like to drink, and I drink just fine, thank you. I enjoy drinking. That damn corn dog, it was always something. You know, I haven't had enough sleep, I'm tired, I'm overstressed, you know, it's always something. It was never the drugs and the alcohol. I never had a clue. A wonderful doctor at the Veterans Administration, I'd been to a lot of doctors for help. You know, I mean, I married two perfectly good wives. You know, two perfectly good gals, but they can't read my mind. And they don't know what I want, I ain't gonna tell them. So, we don't get along. And I've been to marriage counselors, and you know, I've been to biofeedback therapy and pain management classes, and I go to PTSD counseling, and you know, I go to counseling, or you know, I'm just counseling with everybody, you know. And I love the counselors, they give me pills, you know, you give me this pill or that pill, you know, and I take this pill and woo, my hair stands up, whoa, can't take that one, no, and they give me another one, woo, can't wake up, no, let's give me something else, you know. You know, finally got on Valium. God, I love Valium. You know, Valium, woo, home run Valium. Nothing would bother me. I can remember being in a fight with my second wife. She's just mad. She's just going crazy. Now I'm going, look at you. Look at yourself. And I'm so cool. I got it all together. You know, I'm floating in and out of rooms, but I got it all together. Anyway, this one doctor, he properly diagnosed me, and he gave me a battery of tests. I took this battery of tests, ABC, yes, sometimes, no time, never. And came back the next day, and he says, Otto, you're angry. I said, no, shit, I could have told you that without the test. He says, you got a problem with alcohol and drugs. No. I got problems with drugs and alcohol. Did I tell you my brother hung himself? I got problems. Did I tell you my other little brother's in prison? Did I tell you that? Yeah, you don't understand. I got problems, you know. I'm a drinker. I got pain, you know. Well, if you don't go get help, if you don't quit drinking and drugging, you can't hear me and I can't help you. And if you can't hear me and I can't help you, I'm not going to let you waste my time. You ever get indignant? You ever get indignant? I'm a disabled veteran. This veterans counselor, you have to counsel me. No, we don't. No, he don't. He doesn't. So, shoot, golly, okay. You know, I thought maybe I had a problem with Valium. There was a lot of stuff on television back in the 80s about, you know, Valium is being overprescribed. And it's highly addictive. And, you know, I think I might be addicted to Valium. Because I'm always out. Of Valium. And man, when I run out of Valium, I can't swallow water, you know? So, okay, I'll go to treatment. I'll get off the Valium and get on something else. That's the plan. So I entered the care unit, St. Anthony's Hospital in Oklahoma City, July 1st, 1985. And they gave me a medical detox for 10 days, and I needed it. I needed a medical detox. I very much did. But the real gift that I got there is while I was in those classes, you know, and they were teaching me that alcoholism is a disease and that I'm sick, I'm not bad, and I need to learn how to feel. You know, Otto, you only know two feelings, happy and pissed. You know, there's a whole range of emotions out there for you to try to learn to experience, you know. And But the real gift was you guys came up and did what I'm doing tonight. And when you guys would come up and talk, you were the only ones that I couldn't say, you don't understand. Because you all told my secrets. You all told my truths. You all talked about, I don't know that I'd have said some of the things you all said. You know, I'm not one to put myself in anything that's not a favorable light. You know, I kind of like to look good, you know. And you guys are telling some aspersions on yourself. You know, wow, you did that? Oh, I don't think I'd have told anybody. But what happened was, in you, I found myself. In you, I found myself. I could hear you. You know, you didn't say auto you. You said auto I. And when you said auto I, and you told me about yourself, it gave me permission to listen. And as I listened, I found out that we had a lot in common. And you know, I was 37, and it was a 73-year-old black man that knocked down the wall for me. Because he came in and he told his story, and you wouldn't think we had a lot in common, but we drank a lot alike. And the thing that always kept me apart from anybody that ever tried to help me was my disability, my chronic pain. You know, I walked with a horrible limp. I can't sit in a chair. I can't sit down in a chair. You know, I can't ride in the back seat of a car. I can't bend. I haven't touched my left foot in 28 years. I haven't touched my left foot since 1968. I mean, I'm just straight up and down. I have custom furniture in my home. I sit on bar stools. You know, my toilet's like this high, so I got a chance at hitting a hole, you know. Things come out sideways and stuff. It's messy. You don't understand. See, I told you. Anyway, this guy had tried to kill himself, and his life's as unmanageable as mine. And his best plans don't work either. His best thinking sucks, just like mine. He tried to asphyxiate himself by turning on the stove, and he managed to blow up his house and burned himself horribly. He had no fingers. You know, he just had stubs where his fingers had been burned off. And he was black. He was a black man, but he was pink and white, where his skin had all been burned away. And yet, so I couldn't say to him, you know, you don't know what it's like to be in that much pain. You don't know what it's like to be this different, you know. He knew and could describe with the words that I didn't even possess in my vocabulary the life experience that I was having. And the difference was I could tell that he was doing pretty good with it. You know what? He was happy. He wasn't drinking, he wasn't drugging, and he was enjoying himself. He laughed a lot. He was the damnedest thing I ever saw. And he made me really willing to consider what you guys were doing, you know? And after a while, listening to you guys, it was kind of like somebody's been telling a joke and you don't get it, and then all of a sudden you get it. It's kind of like, son of a gun. I'm an alcoholic. Who'd have thunk it? A stud like me. Wow. Huh. You know what? I think my mom. I think my dad. I think my brother. Mom, Dad, we're all alcoholics. Come on, there's help. They weren't excited. They didn't take to it like I did. Anyway, for me, it was good news. I'm like 10 days into treatment, and I'm excited. Because I have tried to change everything I know to change in my life. I've changed wives, hobbies, hangouts, careers, hairstyles, clothes, music, location. I've changed everything I know to change. I used to get big dogs, little dogs. Didn't you? I've changed it. What do you got to do to get happy? You know, what do you got to do to catch a break? You know, what bank do you got to save at, you know, to get some interest? You know, give me some help, you know. And nothing worked. And this gave me new hope. Wow, you know, if this is my problem, then there's hope. Because, you know, you guys have found that through not drinking, your lives have gotten better. You know, the first step says we're powerless over alcohol. Man, that was good news to me. I just thought I was weak. I thought I was a screw up, you know. I just thought I was less than, you know. I need to go to work and I can't, you know. I'm a failure. I just loathed myself. And the idea of my life being unmanageable, that was such a relief. You know, I'm not a screw up. You know, my dad used to teach, practice makes perfect, and where there's a will, there's a way. And if anyone can, you can. And quitters never win, and winners never quit. Exceptions are made for exceptional people. Kill me. Oh, God, it damn near killed me. It was such good news to find out that my life's unmanageable. My best plans don't work, and neither do yours. You know, everybody's life's unmanageable. Practice doesn't make perfect, and where there's a will, there's more often a conflict than a way. Good news for me. You know, the lion that can't catch the little deer and goes hungry, his life's unmanageable. The little deer that can't outrun the lion, his life's unmanageable. Family that plans the picnic and it rains, their life's unmanageable. Every life is unmanageable. But as an alcoholic, I manage to conjure up more than my fair share with the decisions I'm making under the influence of alcohol. With the places I'm going, the things I'm doing, the consequences I'm having, I'm getting more than my share of life on life's terms. It was good news. Gave me some hope. Can't believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore sanity. My nickname was Crazy Otto. Got no problem with that. Made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God. God. Looked at those steps on the wall. God damn. It's a God deal. I can't believe it. Oh, I was furious. I don't believe in God. Oh, I'm furious. St. Anthony's Hospital. It's a Catholic hospital. I should have known better. I should have went to Schick. I should have went to the VA. I should have went somewhere where I could get help. You know, they're going to throw this God at me. Oh, I'm furious. I want out. Check me out. Let me out. Well, if you leave, it'll be against medical advice. Well, I ain't paying for this. Your insurance won't pay. Well, I ain't paying. So I stayed, you know. Didn't have anywhere to go, so I stayed. And it was wonderful because people like you came up, you know, doing our little 12-step thing, stuff we do. We go up and we talk to the sickos, you know, and we come in there. You know, and I'm just a lunatic, you know. And some guy didn't have a lot of sobriety. You don't have to have long-term sobriety to help new people. You know, go up to the hospitals, go up to the prisons, go to those places. You can help people like me. You know, if you just got 30 days, how do you do that? You know, wow. And there was a guy named Mike. I'll never forget him. I mean, he didn't have a lot of sobriety. He wasn't the sharpest knife in the box. And, you know, he's talking to me. He's doing a little 12-step work. And I'm telling him, you know, I don't believe in God. He says, well, you know, what's that all about? I don't know. I'm telling you, if there's a God, he must be a damn terrorist. You know, because where's he been? You know, where was he when my dad's beating my mama? Where was he when I was in Vietnam, my buddies were getting blown to pieces? Where was he when I laid in that hospital bed for almost 2 years? You know, where was he when my brother hanged himself in that jail cell? You know, where's he been when the tornadoes and the floods and the hurricanes and the Holocaust? You know, the minister at my church, Reverend Bill Alexander, when I was a young man, we showed up at church on Sunday and he didn't. He died in a plane crash the night before. God's right-hand man. What good did God do him? And I told him about September 22nd, 1968, the day I was shot. I walked up from that machine gun. There was a short burst of fire. Whack, cut me in two. I spun to the ground. My first thought was, I've been shot. Takes a moment to realize what's happened. It just happened. Second thought, God help me. Third thought, there is no God. September 22nd, 1968, land from me to you. Under an automatic weapon, the enemy got out of their hole, came, took my watch off my wrist. They took a knife, cut the straps off the fresh ruck I was coming back from the LZ with, pulled it off me and got back in their hole, and I could feel that gun pointed at the top of my head. And in that desperate moment, I wasn't willing to believe that I needed any kind of help. I just could not believe that a God would let happen what happened to that legless man the day before. I told Mike that. In all his wisdom and all his long-term sobriety, Mike says, well, Otto, you know, you don't have to believe in the God you gave up on in Vietnam. And with that word, with those words, a gift from him to me, he let me out of that corner I had myself painted into. He gave me the opportunity to look again. He asked me, he says, Otto, what would God have to be for you to take a chance and try and turn your will and your life over to his care, not control. To let him care for you. You get to keep control. That was important for me. I don't like to give up control. I didn't even like being in that treatment center. They wouldn't let me watch what I want to watch on TV, and I'm pissed all the time. So I thought this was really kind of a ridiculous proposal. I always thought I was supposed to figure out what God wanted me to be, you know. You know, what do I have to do to please you? What do I have to do to win grace? You know, what do I have to do to earn my way in? You know, what do I got to do? How good can I be? And Mike says, no, but what would God have to be for you to hook up with him? You know, what is he got to be for you to take a chance and try? And just turn your willing life over to his care. Let him care for you, and you keep control. So I did a little writing, and I came up with a real simple God concept. And I came up with, if God's all-powerful, he's omnipotent, and with all his power, all he wants is for me to stay sober, because I believe I need to stay sober, and like it. There's the hook, you know. I'll quit drinking, stay sober. He'll keep me sober and have me like it. Then I'd be willing to try, not saying that I can, turn my will and my life over to his care. I keep control. And I fully expected Mike to say, oh, no, 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 no. No Disneyland gods. Come on, buddy, pick a team. What are you going to be, Hindu, Muslim, Buddhist, Christian? Come on, pick a team. You want to get you a yellow robe, go to the airport, we'll give you a ponytail? Come on, what team you want to be on? But that's not what he said. He said, okay, that's your God. You pray to that God. Now, I did not believe for a minute that it would work. Not for one. But I don't know about you guys. I usually have a motive hidden in there somewhere. You know, when I'm doing stuff, I usually got something working in the back door that you're not seeing, you know. We're dancing and I'm unhooking your bra or something, you know. You know, you don't know it. Anyway, I figure, okay, I'm going to do everything you guys tell me to do. I'm going to do everything they've said at this hospital for me to do. And I'm going to document it. Because when I get drunk, I'm suing AA. I'm going to own all this. It's going to be mine. I might be drunk, but I am going to be a rich drunk, and I think that'll be okay. And so, you know what? I'd go to my meetings every day, and I'd document in my little calendar, I've been to a meeting today. And I'd call my sponsor, and I'd write down, call Johnny, 1 o'clock. And I'm praying every day. You guys know it, because we're holding hands at the end of the meeting, and we are praying. So I am praying. I'm going to meetings. I'm calling my sponsor. The biggest problem was I was functionally illiterate. Could not read a book. Got to read the book. That's one of the deals. Okay. Well, I got the guys I was in treatment with to come to my house every day. One or two of them would show up every day, and we would read the big book out loud. And I'd write it down. Because I'm going to own AA. And you know what? In spite of my motives, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, 120 days went by, and I haven't had a drink. And you guys are treating me awful kind. You're being awful good to me. You know, you're inviting me out to dinner, you're taking me to the movies, you let me hang out with you, you let me go play even when I'm not very playful. You know, I'm kind of a scary guy. I don't know Khmer from Sikkim, and I don't know any of the rules or nothing, and you guys just let me hang out. And you know, it's not just see you at the club, you take me to your homes and stuff. You know, I mean, it was awesome. And you'd have a 12-step call, you'd call me, say, let's go. And I'm, whoa, I get to hang out with you, you know. It was cool. And, you know, 6 months goes by and I haven't had a drink. Wow. So I decided, you know, maybe I really will turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Maybe this is working. Maybe I'll try. You know, so I did a little more sincere prayer. You know, I wasn't big on prayer. You know, we're praying in the meetings, but I wasn't big on praying by myself at home. You know, I really don't know how to pray. And I forget to pray. I don't know about you. I get up in the morning and I take off, and then I realize, oh, you know, later, you know, I get to the meeting, and that's the first time I've prayed today. I forgot all about it, you know. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and he helped me. He says, you know, he says, you make your bed, Otto? I said, no. He says, why don't you make your bed? He says, make your bed. If the bed's not made, you haven't prayed. Make your bed. As soon as you make it, smooth it off, get down to the end of it, pray. Ask God to keep you sober one more day. So I got in the habit of making my bed every day. You know what I liked having my bed made? I walk by the bedroom, look nice. And I like me a little better for having a bed that's made. You know, I started to like myself a little bit, just doing those simple things. And I walk around through my day and I'm watching for God. I'm waiting to see what he's going to do. You know, and amazing things began to happen. It was amazing as soon as I became willing to see what could happen. George, I'm not going to do it to you. I could tell a lot of stories about the wonderful things that happened, but it's, you know, they told me if I used to do it, don't. If you haven't done it, do. Give it a try. You know, that was pretty much rule 101. You know, and for turning your will and your life over to the care of God, you know, how do you know when you're doing that? You know, rule of thumb for me is if you can't tell anybody you're doing it, it's not God's will. You know, you can do just basically anything you want to do. It's not this little narrow tunnel you got to get down. It's not this narrow, tight path that you got to follow. It's anything you want to do as long as it's not a secret. If I can tell my wife, if I can tell my kids, if I can tell the neighbors, the tax man, the policeman, if I can tell you I'm doing it, then it's God's will for me. Go be happy, Otto. Do what you want. No secrets. You know what? Today I live in a glass house. It's terrific. I have no secrets. You know, I've been married for almost 20 years now. Same woman. We still like each other. Wow. No secrets. Wow, that's the damnest thing you ever saw. Anyway, one of the things I did different was I bought a little dog. A little spaniel. And I used to have big dogs, Doberman Pinschers, you know, go through the door to get your dogs, mean dogs. And so I'm doing it different. I get a little spaniel, you know, a little floppy-eared spaniel. And I haven't been sober very long, but I figure, you know, if I had a frisbee-catching dog, that would be so cool. You know, I could go to the park, throw that frisbee, the girls will just come flocking back to see my little spaniel. Motives. People say motives are important. Baloney. Actions are important. You know what? If you go to school and get a degree because your parents want you to, you still get the degree. You know, motives just dictate whether or not you enjoy while you're doing it. And so anyway, I'm trying to teach Speedway. This is Speedway's her name. And I'm trying to teach her to catch a frisbee. And she don't catch any better than I throw. You know, if I'll throw it right in her mouth, she might get it. She's better at fetching than she is catching. And it's windy in Oklahoma, and I throw that frisbee, and the wind gets it, and it goes up on the roof of the house. Damn. Damn. I don't have a ladder. Damn. My best thinking. Put her paws on the roof, put my hand on her butt, pushed it up. Go get it, girl. Go get it. Go get it. Now, I haven't given a thought to how I'm going to get her down. It's not totally insane. It's a low roof, okay? But what happens is she gets scared. And she don't go to get it. She pees. Oh! Oh, just all over me. All over me. And I put her down on the ground and I start to laugh at myself. I can't believe I was going to do something so stupid. Johnny, you're not going to believe what just happened. God made the dog pee on my head so I wouldn't put her on the roof. He says, I don't know if God did that or not. I guess he could. Why don't you get to a meeting and tell everybody, though? I can't wait to get there and tell y'all what God's doing for me. And I'm sharing that story, you know, and I put her up on her roof and she pees all over me. And I put her down on the ground and I start to laugh at myself. And then I hear myself say something I didn't know I was going to say. My old behavior would have been to kill that damn dog. Ooh. That rolled over me and pushed me back in my seat. That was not a figure of speech. That was the truth. The day before, I'd had that dog down in a chokehold, hitting it with my fists. The neighbor woman come stood at the end of my driveway and told me to leave that little dog alone. I told her to mind her own damn business. And that day, I was changed. You know, God never puts up a post-it note and says, Otto, here comes some change. Get ready. Yeah. Take an extra pair of underwear today, Otto. You're going to shit yourself. Because this is amazing. This is going to be amazing. And what happened was I realized that, you know, I swore I'd never be like my father, and I never hit my wife and kids, but I battered my pets. My whole life. I was just like my dad. It just manifests differently. You know, I didn't learn how to deal with my anger. I didn't learn how to deal with emotions. I didn't learn how to cope. I didn't learn how to communicate. I didn't learn how to talk. I just stuff and stuff and stuff and stuff and drug and dope and drink and stuff and stuff. And it comes out violently at the things I love and care about. And I battered my pets. Now, I'm not proud of that, but I'm damn glad to know it. And I'm damn glad to be free of it. And it was the beginnings of me understanding my father and forgiving my father for doing the very best he could. You know, people had always told me, Otto, your dad did the best he could. Well, it wasn't very damn good. But I began to understand. When I was about 5 years sober, I actually was able to receive the gift of forgiveness from my father. When I buried my father, I buried a loved one, not a lovable one. I'd known the joy of loving my father for years. I learned how to do that in here, loving the newcomer. You know, I never had anybody come in a Mercedes and say, Otto, would you help me? You know, it's always the guy that needs a ride to the laundromat and doesn't have two quarters, you know. But I'd fall in love with these guys. You know, I'd just fall in love with them, trying to help them. You know, I never knew what it was to be altruistic. I never knew what it was to do something for somebody expecting nothing in return. You all taught me how to do that. You all did it for me. And while I'm doing that, while I'm going about cleaning up the wreckage of my past and taking an inventory and finding out the selfish and self-centered is the root of my problem, you know, and that I am afraid, my dad was wrong, I got lots of good cause to be afraid, you know, and that, you know, I'm kind of deviant in my sexual behavior and that I can change that. I can come up with a new plan for myself. Nobody has to design it for me. You know, my life can get better if I'll live different. You don't have to change for me to get happy. Woo, that's a new concept. You know, that I can change if I'll become more tolerant, patient, understanding, less demanding. I can know a new peace. I can know a new freedom. I can clean up the wreckage of my past. I went and made amends and the people didn't respond like I thought they would. I expected you guys to claw my eyes out. I expected you to hurt me and punish me for the things I was going to own that I did to you. And that's not what happened. To a man, to a woman, everyone was excited for me. We are so happy, Otto, that you're finally finding some happiness in your life. We are so happy that you're finding some wellness in your life. Good for you, Otto. And all my fears were cast away. My idea of my fellow was completely changed. You know, most of the worst things that ever happened to me in my life never happened. They're just in my mind. And I just keep doing the steps, and God keeps doing for me what I can't do for myself. I was about 3 years sober. My first wife comes to me. She says, you're doing so good. You take the little bitch before I kill her. And my daughter come to live with me. She's a little bitch. And she's coming from, you know, the guest purses and the Dooney Burke purses and the guest jeans and the hot tubs and the big house up north, you know, and I'm living in a little inner city house with no furniture, you know. And she's not happy to be there. They had to cut the canopy off her bed to get it in this little room I had for her. Oh, God, she was not happy to be there. And, you know, I told her, I said, Holly, I don't know how this is going to work, sweetheart. I'm just going to love you no matter what. You know, I'm just going to love you the way we love each other in AA. You know, and I believe that God loves us because he's God, not because we're good. And I'm just going to love you because I'm your dad. She was not impressed. She set about to make my life a living hell. And I mean, I'm doubling up on my meetings, and I've been going to Al-Anon for 20 years, folks. If you've been sober a while and you're not liking it, and if you've been sober a while and you're having trouble having a long-term relationship, come on over. We'll invite you in because I got sober in AA and I got happy in Al-Anon. I did not know how to have a healthy relationship. And I made good on that promise to my daughter. You know what? When she wouldn't pick up her room or take her dishes out of the room and take them back into the kitchen and whatnot, instead of telling her she's a pig, which is what I wanted to tell her, you pig, I'd call my sponsor and he'd say, Otto, she's not a pig. She's just a little girl in a dirty room. New concept. You know, she needs to clean it up. No, you just need to close the door. Mind your own business. She throws a hula hoop down on the floor. Says, get in there. She says, everything's in there is yours. You take care of anything that's in that hoop. Everything else is God's. Mind your own business. She's my daughter, not your business. I tried to just love my daughter. She'd been with me a couple of years, and we're doing good. We're doing better. She turned 16, I bought her a little car. You know, just a little car, a little crap car. You know, she's a crap driver. She can't see, you know, she's a curb banger. And I'm tired of driving her all over town. My motives are selfish, you know. I don't want her to have her own car, so I don't have to tote her everywhere. And so I bought her this little crap car, this little prelude, you know, you push on the gas, it just makes more noise. It doesn't go fast or anything. She can't get hurt in it, I figure. And one night she comes to me, she says, Dad, can Kristen and I take your car? I had this really cool little convertible, you know, that I just had restored and painted and new convertible top, kicker stereos, and then cool wheels, you know. Okay, be careful. Be careful. You know, put the top down, away they went, just gleeful. You know, just gleeful. Wasn't 30 minutes. Ring! Dad, I'm going too fast, and I crashed the car. You okay? Kristen, okay? Can you drive the car? Where yet? Where they're not supposed to be. Stay right there. I'll be right there. I'll be right there. Stay right there. All bets are off. This little bitch is dead. Anything but my car, man. Not my car. And I'm on my way out to get her in that little prelude. And it will not get me there fast enough, and I am pissed. Because I know I'm going to be driving it for a while. And I've got that conversation going on in my head, you know, where she's going to say, and then I'm going to say, and then I'm going to say, and then she's going to say. And I don't know if you've ever had conversations with people that aren't there, but I do it. And while I'm having this conversation, I hear a gift. A gift. Post-it note. Dad, Dad, I was going too fast. And I crashed the car. That's unheard of. She copped to it. She owned it. She told the truth. She trusts me with the truth. I told my dad, a deer ran out in front of me and I swerved to miss it. I was just going too fast, is the truth. My dad beat the hell out of me, picked me up by my ear. Didn't I tell you to be careful? Don't you know what that car means to this family? Don't you know what that's going to do to insurance? Beat me damn near to death. And that night I was able to go to Holly and comfort her. She knows what that car means to me. I don't have to tell her. She knows what it's going to do to insurance. I don't have to tell her. She knows I told her to be careful. I don't have to remind her. She's dying. She's dying. She knows she screwed up. She's hurt the person she most wants to please. Isn't that a great time for Dad to come whip your ass? You know, when you're hurting. Thank you, God, for letting me love my daughter. Be her loving father. When I did my inventory on that evening, you know, the only thing that was wrong that evening was that when she asked for the car, I didn't have the courage to say no. My problems are of my own making, all of them. I'm afraid she won't like me if I have to tell her no. Grow up. Okay, 7 years sober. I'm at the car races on Friday night, like always. I go to the races every Friday night. And something makes me get up and go home in the middle of the races. Racing's my passion. But I get up in the middle of a perfectly good evening, good track, good car count, beautiful weather, and I go home. And I don't know why. I'm walking out of the grandstands feeling sad. Where's my passion? I don't know. I walk into my house. My wife says, what are you doing here? I said, I don't know. I just soon watch TV. Friday night, 9 o'clock. Turn on television, ABC, 2020. Barbara Walters and Hugh Downs. First little vignette comes on, shows a helicopter flying over the jungles of Vietnam. Vignette's called The Gift of Life. And it's about a guy writing a book on emergency room trauma, and he's interviewing the top trauma specialist in the nation. And he asks him, what was your worst trauma case you ever had to handle? And Dr. Swan began to recount when he was a young surgeon at the 71st Medevac in Pleiku, Vietnam in 1968, and they brought in a young soldier who was so gravely wounded. The consensus was to medicate him, set him aside, declare him expectant, and let him die. His legs are gone. He's got an arm mangled. He's got shrapnel the size of your thumb in the middle of his brain. Both his eyes are gone. He's blind. He's legless. He's brain damaged. His arm's mangled. Let him die. Dr. Swan went against the consensus and operated on the young man and saved his life. And the guy writing the book says, how'd that turn out? Dr. Swan didn't know. He'd not even thought about it again. Took him 2 years to find the young man. His name's Kenneth McGarity, and he lives in Columbus, Georgia. And they start to tell his story. And he's a young crew chief on a helicopter trying to drop firefighting equipment to infantrymen pinned down in a burning jungle on September 21st, 1968, and a rocket comes out of the trees. And I sat on the sofa, and I just shook. My wife came over and sat down next to me and hugged on me. She says, what's the matter? I mean, I'm just trembling. And I said, this is my kid. This is my nightmare. This is my story they're telling. And it was. Part of the story is Ken struggles with PTSD. He's married since Vietnam to a gal he met talking on CB radio. He's fathered 2 children with no legs. He's off at the hips. He don't even have stumps. He can feel with 2 fingers on his right hand. His left hand is useless. He has no eyes. He's not partially sighted. He has no eyes in his head. And he's fathered 2 kids. He scuba dives. He sails. But he struggles. He abuses alcohol and drugs. And he doesn't know what happened to him on the day he got shot. And he can't seem to get home from Vietnam. Now, when I did my 4-step, I told my sponsor I'd do anything except go back to Vietnam. And he said, well, in God's time, do what you can. Well, it was God's time. Because I reached out to Kenny not knowing what was going to happen, but Kenny drugged me back into those jungles. I could prove to him that I was who I said. He didn't believe me at first, but I was decorated by the commander of his helicopter for heroism that day. And when I gave him the name of the guy who sighted me, he knew it was the commander of his helicopter, and he couldn't deny that it was I and a kid named Henderson that saved him that day. So Kenny and I started talking to each other. And I'm trying to help him home, and he's dragging me back into that hell. And I'm angry. I'm angry. But he's here in this program. He's here in this program. And long story short, Kenny got sober. Yeah. Kenny's sober 14 years now in Columbus, Georgia. He doesn't go to meetings. Very hard for him to get around. His life is very difficult. But when he's at the hospital at Fort Bend, I was talking to him the other day, and he says, well, he's at the hospital at Fort Bend, he says, Otto, I go visit the soldiers coming back from Iraq. And I tell him it's okay that they're all blowed up. He says, I carry a message of hope. I'm a messenger of hope. You taught me that. While this is going on, I'm angry. Not about you, but I got to make sense of things. And so I'm trying to figure out why I'm so angry. You know, he's taking me back to hell. But I decided, okay, I'm angry because this son of a bitch has yet to tell me thank you for saving his life. That made sense to me. And every time I hang up on the phone, no thank you. You know, I'm waiting. It's becoming an issue. You know, this guy owes me a debt of thanks. It was no small feat what I did that day. You know, and I've lived with these nightmare images of him all these years. I don't think a thank you is too damn much to ask for. So he asked me to send him some stuff, and I put a cover letter with it, and then, like, he's going to read it. I put a cover letter with it. Theresa will read it to him, his wife, okay? And in the cover letter I wrote, Kenny, I got a resentment. You've never told me thank you for saving your life. Phew, felt good to get it out there, man. You know, I just needed to get it out. Made the mistake of showing it to my wife. She looks at it, she goes, what is this? You never said thank you. That doesn't belong in there. And I said, oh, yes, it does. It's the truth, and I live in the truth. She says, oh, no, 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 no. Isn't there some kind of a spiritual thing where you guys, you know, if there's a bug up your ass, it's your bug or something, you know? If somebody bothers you, you know, it's you. Went back to my little word processor. I'm just going to edit it out. I don't want to rewrite the whole damn letter. I'm just trying to make it make sense, you know, so I can just mail it. And what comes out? Post-it note. Kenny, I never said thank you. For all those years, I'd never seen anything but me running into a burning jungle to help Kenny. Truth, I'm trapped in a burning jungle. Kenny's safe in a helicopter. Kenny flies into harm's way, trying to help me. And that rocket hit that helicopter. He gave his sight, he gave his legs, and he entered into that darkness and that disability for me. No one had ever told him, thank you, Kenny. Thank you for your sacrifice. And it healed me. Selfish, self-centered, that is the root of my problem, I self-manifest in 1,000 ways. God is in his heaven and all is right on earth. Get in harmony with God's reality, Otto. Be open to some new thoughts, new ideas. Everything you see is not real. Everything you feel is not real. Everything you think is not true. Open yourself to God. I'm happier, healthier, more whole physically, emotionally, socially, legally, financially, maritally, parentally than I've ever been in my life. They told me if I could ever go 10 years without infection, I'd be a candidate for an artificial hip. I couldn't go 2. 10 years sober, I'm 10 years without infection. Go figure. You know, I thought I drank and I ate the pills because I had the pain. And today I know I had the pain because of what I did to myself under the influence of drugs and alcohol. You know what? A person with my disability needs to moderate. I never walked with a cane. I never parked in a handicapped slot till I came to you. You know, when I knew I couldn't medicate myself, when I couldn't drug myself up, I stopped abusing myself. And when I stopped abusing myself, I healed. And today I got a wonderful hip. I can sit in a chair just like you. I can put my elbows on my knees. I can sit on a regular toilet. I can cut my own toenails. Don't tell my wife. I like it better when she does it. But the best part is, I'm pain-free. Pain-free. There is nothing too great for God to resolve. Whatever problems you bring, whatever difficulties, whatever your struggles, whatever brought you here, there's a lot more going on than just not drinking and not drugging. There's happiness, true peace, living in the promises of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks for letting me come and share with you.